Hello, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And it's an absolute thrill to be able to say you're joining me for a chat with Carlos Alomar, a man who thankfully needs no introduction to you, the wise and knowledgeable Album listener. Thankful, because if I did have to do an introduction, I'd be here all week. So let's just agree, we all know just who Carlos is. We know what he's done. We have some sense of his immeasurable contribution to Bowie's career and music. We love his defining work on albums and tours, from Young Americans to the Serious Moonlight Tour and beyond. And importantly, we also know that in a few weeks' time, he's reuniting with the bassist George Murray and going on tour in the Damn Trilogy Back to Berlin Tour to revisit the glory days of Alomar, Murray, and the late great drummer Dennis Davis. Well, you know all that. And if you haven't got your ticket yet for the Damn Trilogy Tour, what are you waiting for? It's Carlos Alomar. So in this, the first part of an enjoyably sprawling chat, we talk about, amongst other things, the birth of the Damn Trio, Carlos's memories of working with George and that percussive genius Dennis Davis, and also something of Carlos's own backstory, from being fined by James Brown for not hitting him when requested, playing session guitar with Peter, Paul and Mary, or even when he took a Monkees classic and turned it into a raw, funky techno-pop classic for David Bowie. So there's a lot to be discussing. So in the wise words of Marty DeBerge, what do you say? Enough of my yakking. Let's boogie.
I'm going to go back to the original thing that we talked about. Technology and the advent of the Macintosh computer back in 1977-ish. And we got the Brian Eno Berlin Trilogy. And in a way, during that time is when the emergence of the Damn Trio happened. It actually happened in Station to Station.
Yeah.
But if you want to know what happened now, I'll tell you what started it now, but we'll go back to when we first started. We got together for the David Bowie World Fan Convention in Liverpool, and George and Murray was invited as a guest. I was very excited over knowing that he would be there. And so when we got together, it was awesome. Not only was the storylines and the storytelling fabulous, but the house band that was there to perform the Bowie song asked us to perform as well. Man, you know what it's like when you get together with your mate. And he hasn't lost anything. And the band, when we went to rehearsals, was somewhat square. And the minute George and me started playing, it started swinging like we do. Yeah. And it drives, you know. And even the band was like, oh, yeah. Now this sounds like the record. Why? I played three guitar parts at the same time. But when they hear it, they need three guitar players to play
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Also, I do funny tricks when we're recording, like I detune my guitar to get the one note that's not in that range. But I detune the guitar, put it in that range, and then keep playing. And so these little tricks.
So it sounds crazy because it's
well, detuned. It sounds like three people have to do it.
Yeah.
But then when you hear me do it by myself, it's just like, holy smokes. Oh my God, that's the way you play it? Anyway, we got together and the music was amazing. Obviously, the minute musicians get that, we get the idea of, oh my, let's put the band back together again. But as you know, like you said, Dennis Davis wasn't there. But the real reality hit me when we left the convention. The reality was that the California fires almost got George. A lot of my friends lost their house, they lost everything. I immediately called George. Are you okay? He had left his place. He had gone to a hotel far away. He was safe. But right then and there, I realized not only did we lose Dennis Davis the same year as Bowie, which is why I kind of was heartbroken and I did not want to do anything. But the fact that I thought I might have lost George, put the band back together again was not just a thought. And while I was at the convention, the fans who had seen us play, they were like, you all need to go on tour. Mm. And I told the fans, don't talk to me. You see that guy over there? He's a promoter. Talk to him. Hound him. Well, man, they hounded him. And when I called him up, you know what? He was like, Carlos, I can put a tour together for you. And it'll only be for a month. And then I realized, you know what? Let's go back to where it all started. I know that this is the year of young Americans, but I wanted to honor Dennis Davis and David Bowie, because we have had all these Bowie celebrations and celebrating Bowie and all the cover bands and all the alumni bands and everything. I was like, I don't have anything to do with the Spiders from Mars. I don't have anything to do with the, at the end of his life, Black Star stuff. I don't have nothing to do with the jazz bands that he did. I don't have anything to do with Tin Machine. You know what I've got to do with? The period of scary monsters down to Station to Station of Scary Monsters. And of course, I continued on. But I want to concentrate on what I know I can deliver. The songs that you never heard before from that trilogy, and Station to Station, and Scary Monsters. Those are the songs I want to do. Yeah. The songs that you haven't heard before because they're a little bit complicated, or Bowie didn't want to do them. And every time I heard a cover band do it, they got it all wrong. And, oh my God, they are so square. They don't swing. They got no pocket. And me, when I do my arrangements for all the Bowie tours, man, that's got to be like, I'm an arranger. I got to have everything. And so when I hear the way that they do it, I'm like, you know what? Let them do what they do. Me, stay out of there. And I wanted to get an actor that sings, not a singer that can't act. I also did not want a parade of curiosity seekers that are, oh my God, a movie star that's going to sing a song. I wonder, oh, what does he sing? The old Spiders from Mars, 5 years and all those other songs. You know what? I don't want you to concentrate on any one person singing. I want you to concentrate on the lyrics of David Bowie. If you could just imagine, and if you have one person singing them and delivering the message, you can forget his face and Bowie is there. Yeah. Also, the consistency of the performance is better controlled when I have one singer, just like Bowie. And after a while, you're going to be entertained by that one person. And he's an actor that sings. Why? I need him to command the stage. I do not need somebody holding on to a microphone. I mean, that's not I need an entertaining show, not a show that is musically correct. Here's why. Every time we go and see a show, the music is always perfect. Even if it's not, you just remember it in your mind's ear as being, it was right. They made no mistakes. It's not about the music. It's about the singer. Well, if you're there to see a Bowie tribute, I don't want to see a lot of people. I'm fine with seeing one good singer. And he'll deliver whatever it is that he has to deliver, and you'll get the show. And so I decided to do it like that. George Murray and I got together, and because of the fear of losing George, I figured the time is now. And in so doing it, I put together a band that will look at the technological advances that are done and be able to give me a type of show that also uses a lot of the technology. So instead of getting three singers, I got one singer that uses a TC Helicon as a harmony machine. And when she sings, she can sound like a man. She can sound like the Beach Boys. She can sound like a 14-piece choir. She can sound like the Supremes. And that texturizing makes it very important. Me, I'm not playing a guitar. I'm playing a synthesizer guitar. And the synthesizer guitar allows me to play my guitar, but then you also hear a piano in the verse. And when it gets to the chorus, you also hear an organ playing in the background somewhere. And so this technology has to also be brought in to represent the dynamic period that we had during the Berlin Trilogy with Brian Eno. Mind you, now we have to go back. When Bowie left the Europe, England, he had the Spiders from Mars, and they gave him a signature sound that was relevant to the time that he was there. He comes to America, and he meets me. Before that, he had his band with Ava Cherry, Jeff McCormick, his friends from there. He had the Astronauts, I think they called it, with Ava.
Yeah.
And so he already had a little... I love R&B. He's a Brit. And so if you can get your hand on a record any record from America. You were like the most popular kid in town.
It was absolutely foundational for him. I mean, as a mod in 1960s London, R&B, any black music was the gospel.
If you had a record player and if you could get the record.
If you could get the record.
And if you did, you were the most popular kid in town. He ends up coming here, and you can tell in the early attempts with the Astronettes, I think they were called, he's trying to get it to have that Philly sound, to have that kind of, it doesn't quite work. It's square. They ain't got a groove.
Yeah.
And then he gets together with Mike Garson, and he does the Diamond Dogs, which still has the same components as the Spiders from Mars.
Do you mean the album or the tour?
The album and the tour, once you start looking at the songs, he's still doing Life on Mars. He's still doing, he is introducing the Diamond Dogs album, but the sound still has Earl Slick mimicking Ronson. It's still the same rock and roll. Then he meets me. I'm at RCA Studio doing, session work. And so what we find is that when I hooked up with him, he finally got that swing. Why? We get together for the Young Americans album, and I introduce him to Dennis Davis. Wow, great. And then for Station to Station, we get George Murray. That created the scenario that as a band leader, I told him, I prefer not to work with a piano player. Not that I don't like piano players, but like in the old jazz days, we had jazz comping, and that meant the guitar and bass and drums were basically the rhythm section, and a pianist was considered a soloist.
Yeah.
And so that being said, David was like fine with it, and that's where everything started. The fact that the rhythm section was now rhythm guitar, bass, and drums left David with this lovely ambiance that the groove was solid. There were no particular what we call leading tones. That's when the piano player plays the C, but that damn pinky is adding C, C major 7, C sharp. It's like adding, Hendrix said it best. If I got a loose finger, I could do a lot of damage. Anyway, that being said, we had this situation where the Berlin Trilogy introduced electronica. Let's remember, like the typewriter that I spoke of before, the Macintosh computer was introduced. Oh my God. When that little Mac came out, I bought one and I realized I can record on the road. I can, the world is my oyster. I invented a synthesizer guitar with a photon laser beam system so that I could trigger it. Why? Every time I tried to trigger something with the guitar, the low E strings were so fat that I would get latency. So I changed all the strings to be the thin, thin E string that's on top.
All six strings with the top E string.
Yes. So A, it cut into my fingers. B, I had to get a transformer that would take the note and lower it to the pitch that I needed it. And so we modified the guitar to enable us to do all of that. That being said, we have to acknowledge the fact the recognition of that Berlin Trilogy was given to Brian Eno because of the advent of technology and the ability for us at that point to do electronic music it's like a computer doing symphony.
Yeah.
And so I have absolutely no problem that all the accolades were given to Brian Eno and to that also Robert Fripp. Mm. Okay. It does create a dilemma in that the true artistry actually should be given to the rhythm section. They laid it down, and look, anybody can come in and do an overdub when everything is fabulous underneath it. But we mustn't go there very quickly because, again, we had no name. Without a brand, you can't do anything. Oh, there were these three black guys that worked with David. That's all they could say. Who were they? I don't know. Who was the drummer or the bass player for the Spiders from Mars? Maybe you don't know that, but the brand, the Spiders from Mars, everybody knows the brand. So although we were there, we had no brand.
You needed to be an entity.
Exactly.
A kind of wrecking crew or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And until that time, all the credit was given to the advent of technology and electronica and the fact that Brian Eno was a messenger for it and the absurdity of having a Robert Fripp type of solo smashing all through it, creating and disseminating boundaries of, I mean, it was amazing. And then I did an interview years later and labeled ourselves as the damn trio, Dennis Davis, Carlos Salomar, and George Murray. After that, then everybody started saying, oh, the damn trio this, the damn trio that. I totally get it. So at that point, that's when everything started happening, when actually we had a name and people could actually say the damn trio was this and the damn trio was that. But the lack of recognition, I think, was not intentional. I think that it was a part of the technology and the brilliance of Brian Eno and Robert Fripp. They actually were a gigantic component. You never heard any music like that. And so, you know, the credit is due. But now I wanted to do something that accents the recognition that is due to the damn trio.
Absolutely.
And yes. So to that, and in a way, I did not want to use many alumni.
Right.
They've already done that. And if they come in, they're already labeled with the other Bowie.
It changes the dynamic of what you're doing. I sense what you are trying to get at here is this was a very unique, discrete entity that was at the core of the compositional recording process. And now's the time to essentially foreground what you, Dennis, and George did. Maybe we can go a little bit into the dynamics of the Damn Trilogy. Noted down a few questions I wanted to ask you, if that's
please.
Okay. So I guess the first one is I read somewhere where you talked about the rhythmic space when you would collaborate with George and Dennis. And I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit. You know, was there something specific about how the three of you approach rhythm that kind of set you apart?
Well, I just finished doing a documentary called We Want the Funk. You can see it on YouTube. And basically, it tells you exactly what it is. James Brown taught me, don't disturb the groove. And so what you have is a rhythm section that when we lay something down, we don't have to move. Mm. You see, when a lot of musicians get together, they feel like they have to impress you. So they never really play the same thing twice. They start grooving and then they start putting themselves, their kind of little touches on it. I totally get that. And it's perfectly okay.
Yeah.
But it does create a looseness. And what happens is you lose what we call the pocket. There's a certain groove that's laid down that when you do it just right, the music swings. And when the music swings, don't disturb the groove. Don't add none of your stuff. Why? After 12 songs, I know every lick you play. Why? Because you keep spilling it on every damn song. And you repeat yourself. Why? Muscle memory is playing, and you mustn't do that. You have to say, we're studio musicians. We're hired to create a signature line. I'm not there to play something that I've been playing in my house for like 5 months, and now I want to put it on your record. I'm there to listen and hear myself in the groove. And then when I hear myself in the groove, then I got to ask myself, holy shit, Carlos, can you play that? Now I got to find out. I hear it. Yeah, I play it. Now that I play it, I'm like, that's the groove. And like James Brown, I hear three guitars, but the first guitar has got to just be still and just leave room. If I hear three guitars, I can't play everything on that first guitar.
That stillness you talk about, that's something I very much think about with James Brown's 60s work, especially, you know, it's like almost metronomic, the way he has that rhythm. Is it true? Was it a rock myth that he had that famous practice of fining people? Is it true that you quit his band because you were fined?
Yes. Oh, no. I didn't quit his band. I was fired. That's different.
Okay.
Yes. What happened was that if you notice any of the shows that he does, he'll always go hit me or something, or he'll turn around.
Yeah.
So the practice, which I did not know about, was he's actually trying to say hit me so he catches you. And if you're unprepared, then he goes like that. Wah! That's $20. If he does it like that, he caught you two times and you weren't ready by surprise. Hit me! You notice he never gives you a cue. He never does any. He just goes, bam. Well, man, I'm not that kind of guy where you can just take money. I'm a married guy and I answer to a higher power, my wife. If I say I bring home $120, honey, I can't bring home $100. And then she says, what happened to the $20? I was fined. Fined for what? He said, is there anything else that you could be fined for? I don't know, honey. I can't come back with that. Look, if you're fining me for this, is there anything else that I should know about? Response, yeah, you're fired. That's it. It's as simple as that. The tour manager can do that. And here's why. Just like me, I didn't have to rehearse James Brown material. You have to know, as a guitar player, if you don't know James Brown material, you're not a guitar player. Mm. I was raised at the Apollo Theater. I was the youngest player in the Apollo Theater house band. I was playing James Brown. I was 17, 18. I could play it. And you know, here's another philosophical thought. I don't need to work with you 18,000 years. Mm. I only need to work with you once. And I get the credit. I mean, I'm working at RCA Studio. I just finished recording Peter, Paul, and Mary's album. They're a folk band. What am I doing as an electric guitar player? I was one of the few guitar players to ever work with Peter, Paul, and Mary on electric guitar. I don't need to do all their albums. I'm a session musician. I put it down as one of my credits. The Main Ingredient, James Brown, mm-hmm. Edwin Starr, you know, all that. And so, you know, the issue became that when I joined Bowie, Bowie heard what he always knew he wanted. Funk. The ability for us to groove. Listen to Station to Station. Dun, 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 dun. Man, for 4 minutes, he wanted Kraftwerk.
Yes.
He wanted the methodology, the rhythm,
he wanted the syncopation. That sort of cold, mechanical, repetitive.
We not only were we a metronome, we had the power. Influences, and you'll notice we're playing a straight four out of the clear blue sky. We'll turn that shit around and make a 6-4 and then slide in a 7-4 beat and then come right back. Rock and roll guys don't know anything about that. I play an E11 to an E9. Rock and roll guys play E and B. They don't play 11th chords, they don't play 9th chords, they don't play progressions. They go from 1 to 4. They don't go 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
So when I made all the arrangements and I did all the stuff, the deepest stuff that you heard was the Berlin Trilogy and Scary Monsters. Now let's be aware, those periods were totally different, all of them. We started the Berlin Trilogy in reality with Iggy Pop. In 1977, he brought us in for the Idiot. And so that's our first introduction to Berlin and the whole thing. And so he knew then, these jazz guys can do punk. If they can do punk, rock ain't nothing. And so that type of introduction led us to, and look, mind you, 1977 for me was brutal. I did two albums for Bowie. Low and Heroes.
Yeah.
And then we did Iggy. I did two albums for Iggy too. But because RCA wanted to postpone Iggy, they launched David Bowie first. But we recorded Iggy first. So they launched David Bowie first. Then they launched Iggy. And then they launched another Bowie. And at the same time, my daughter Leah Lauria was born, 1977. Oh,
so that was one hell of a year for you. That was crazy.
Creative on many levels.
Yeah, exactly. Very creative. But how did you find working with Tony and Hunt Sales on Iggy's album? Because obviously these guys must have been a very different proposition for you than working with George and Dennis.
We have to remember that we have to also look at personalities, and personalities influence the way that you play. An apologetic personality does not mean that you're going to play apologetically. In fact, quite honestly, the opposite might occur, which is what happened with Hunt. Hunt, although he might seem a little bit this and that in the beginning, personally, what he says on those drums, he's a madman. And so you meet somebody and then suddenly they play drums and it's just like scary monsters, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But as a musician, we're trained to listen. Do not put your fingers on the guitar. Just listen. And so when you hear them, they're not playing complicated stuff. You need to dummy down. Whatever you were going to put in there, dummy that down. Do not start trying to complicate it and be all sophisticated. No, you got to go with the way that they're flowing.
You kind of meet them on that level.
Exactly.
And work with them.
Yeah, because look, if you have everything, then you got to know when to not give it.
Very
true. Cannot throw the kitchen sink when all you need is a little sponge, you know. And so that introduced us to a methodology that wasn't quite what we were used to, because it broke it down very, very simplistically. But that gave us the ability to bring that same type of force to the trilogy when we started in Low. And so when you start looking at that, we mustn't confuse all the ambient stuff. We have to look at the hits, you know, the golden years, the red sails, the, you know, from Station to Station to Heroes, golden years. These are classic rock and roll songs, you know, that mark
Red Sails, especially. I think Red Sails has to be one of my absolute favorite tracks. It is absolutely steeped in krautrock. I mean, it has that, I think you're playing this utterly gorgeously demented shrieking.
You know what I got? You know what I got? If I could show you my line for that song.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard a song called Last Train to Clarksville?
Yes. The Monkees, Heart and Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
Last Train to Clarksville.
You can't hear it.
On Red Sails.
Yeah. You can't hear it. You can't hear it. Maybe you can. I started with take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. I met Bowie during those Apollo years. When he came to my house, I played him the whole Jimi Hendrix album because I was so, when I learned Jimi Hendrix, I was like, oh my God, yeah. I just shed it for like a month. I learned every solo. And so when he came to my house, he knew, oh yeah, he's funky.
Yeah.
But Carlos can play some lead and Carlos can mimic David, Jimi Hendrix. So there's so many songs that on these tracks. And remind you, sometimes I'll play guitar lines and David will give those guitar lines to other people to play.
Yeah.
Because it's a signature line, but they can play it in a certain way. And my sound was very small because as a rhythm guitar player, I'm not there to like create this wall of rock and roll sound.
Yeah.
You know, I leave that to the Slickies and whoever else he decides to get. Again, it's an issue also know your place and also know what you're there for. You're not there to impress you with playing every guitar line necessary. I'm there to give you orchestral movements and give you a certain chordal integrity. Rock and roll is four chords. I don't do four chords. I like to entertain myself and see if I can throw something in there to mess with myself before I even mess with Bowie. Bowie was always appreciative of the ability, if he doesn't like something, or not even say he doesn't like it, let me hear something else. Boom. We can flip on a dime, man. If you don't like this groove, we got a million grooves. I mean, there's a certain amount of consistency in the offerings. That's very, very important, because although you want to constantly progress your sound, there is a basis for that sound to stay the same as well. And so for you to be able to carry it over to the next record and the next record after that, you're looking at almost five albums of a particular sound that created this ability for him to have not only hits, but a background that he could morph. Keep this, add that. And as long as you add the other components, it turns into something else. I mean, mind you, look, he had a very simple philosophy, which is if you want to change the sound, change the band.
Yes.
Totally get it. I had the Young Americans with background singers and all that. That's a different arrangement. Then we had the, you know, Raw Moon, which was the Isolar tour.
Yes.
With Stacey Hayden and Tony Kaye. And that was, and then we had Roger Powell. And then we had the Borneo Horns for the Serious Moonlight tour. And then we had, so I'm constantly given challenges, because I always say there are no problems. There are only challenges. And I want to be challenged, so bring it on. Every time I get a new band, I got to do new arrangements of the songs. So, you know, the Berlin Trilogy had a certain sound, like you mentioned, the Kraftwerk, the precision of it. And then we left that because I was up to here with ambient music. And when we got to the point of Scary Monsters, we told David, look, man, we're here to do the album, but dude, that fucking music, man. Come on, man. Let
no
us
more
go.
Ambient music.
Can you? No. And look, he was kind of done with it on Lodger.
I always feel like Dennis, in everything, like you said earlier, he turned, you know, you all turn on a dime, but him especially so, he's always driving the beat forward. And how did his unique style, his very Dennis Davis style, allow you and George to sort of explore these complex textures and melodies that you're talking about, really without stepping on each other's parts?
You gotta have chops.
Yeah, I guess so.
You gotta have chops. What happens is, that which you hear, you analyze, I could play that, but I have 10 other choices. Which one do I use? The drummer is charged with two things. A, you're the metronome. I follow you. Number two, you have to have a transition from part one to part two. And a drum fill is usually the one.
Yeah.
Number three, you have to have the ability to flip the beat. What's that? Flipping the beat means that every once in a while, if you should walk into a room, but you don't hear the band playing exactly at the beginning of the song, and you come in somewhere in the middle, you start bobbing your head, but you're not on the beat. You're not on the one. You're on the two. And you realize something's wrong. And then you're like, oh, it's like when you're marching out of step and you have to do that little hop in order to get back in step. Flipping the beat is something that Dennis can do. And here's why. You'll have most drummers that do not concentrate on what we call the hi-hat. They just keep time with the hi-hat. Dun, 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 crack. Dun, dun, crack. Dun, dun, crack. Con, 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 crack. Dennis could do a roll with one hand. So he could do. That damn rakataka. How are you going to lose your, if you're playing four, two, 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 I could get lost and the tempo could shift in between there. But when you're playing 16th notes, watermelon, 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 taka-chuka, taka-chuka, you don't lose the beat when it's 16th notes. Now, if you're playing 30 second notes, you can never lose the beat. Why? Yeah. There's too many fragments in between.
Yeah.
He thinks in 30 second notes, and then he doesn't play half of them, but he will right. play one of them that's off of the beat and then come right back to the beat. And on the other hand, the reason that I cannot hire half of the drummers that play with Bowie is because they only have four tom-toms. Dennis Davis thinks, when you have eight drums, I mean, once he had these drums that were like funnels, they yes. scooped out.
Yes, I've seen. Yes.
Dude, they must have been like nine drums. And then he's got a cowbell. And then he's got a maybe a little bongo thing.
Watching film of Dennis, I always felt this was a man who was about to run out of things to hit. He just needed to be surrounded by things to hit. He clearly was hearing the symphony in his head.
Well, he comes from an era of scat. And so what you don't know is he used to scat.
Yeah.
And so if you ever hear him playing, you'll always hear...
What, this kind of vocal, just this noise coming
out? It's like when you hear a lot of stuff, you can scat it, but you can't play it.
Yeah.
And when you scat in the jazz, you never scat da 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 da. Hell no. You're scatting in 30 second notes. He is scatting on the drums. George is the king of the metronome. Why? He plays in eighth notes. Dun 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 dun.
Eighth notes, right.
Yeah.
Right.
We call that cherry. Cherry, 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 cherry. You see, a quarter note. Plum, 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 plum. Cherry, 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 cherry.
Carlos, I didn't realize that you assign fruits to all these things. You were just saying now for Dennis, watermelon, watermelon, watermelon,
watermelon. You want a whole note? You go food. Half note. Cake.
You know, I think for your upcoming tour, you guys have got the merch stand sorted out now. You just have to have watermelons, cherries, get the whole thing up there.
I teach guitar method and musicology by playing games. Games can render anything simple. And so even when I do arrangements, it's rather funny. David Bowie and I have a relationship that is based on humor and intellect. Those two in combination can get you over everything. Now, David was an extremely intelligent man and knowledgeable and well-spoken. And so, as you can tell, I don't mind jargon. I don't mind rhetoric. I don't mind colloquialisms. I don't mind slang. I don't mind a lot of it. But there has to be a certain amount of intellect involved in the discovery of things. And so that relationship that David and I had was one of that. Plus, I was a Buddhist when I was 20, in my 20s. So when David met me, I was already established and a married man and responsible. And the only reason I turned him down is because I got a family to support, bro. Mm. I can't play around with you unless you're going to pay me the money I deserve. And I understand the value of my worth. And in doing so, so did he. So, but we digress. Dennis and George allowed me any thought that I have. I told George one time, George, when you play your notes, don't come back to one. You could play dun 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 dun. I was like, George, don't hit the one. In funk music, it's the one that counts. Don't hit the root on the one. So he would play dun 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 dun. And by doing that, he creates figures that you don't come back to the one until four bars pass. It creates the dynamic that when you hear something, it doesn't quite lodge in your mind as being repetitive. A one bar phrase that you repeat four times, dude, that is so fucking boring. We don't play that. We have to play something that will disengage your brain into a longer pattern so we can put more in it. And later on, when somebody comes to do an overdub and they don't hear you come back to the one, that gives them the opportunity to play something for a longer amount of time and never feel like they have to repeat it every bar. These kinds of manipulations, these type of things, they allow David to constantly be listening and saying, that's that one. Like I've always said in interviews, it's like a Chinese menu. One from column A, two from column B. And for dessert, give me that little bridge thing that you got. And so many times we had that situation where we have to kind of jam it out in the studio. And look, we all know that there's a subjectivity about additive and subtractive thinking. Additive, I know what I want. Give me that. Yeah. The other one is, I don't know what I want, but when I hear it, that's what I want. That's exactly what I meant to say. And so that's the way we were able to get a lot of that material and still not really do it so that it sounds finished.
By having those subtle shifts and movements rather than exactly sort of like right. the conventional on the one. And that's interesting because that was leading me actually into a question I really wanted to ask. When you hear tracks like, you know, Fashion, for example, which is very metronomic, would that have been the result of a lot of evolution in the studio, or did the three of you find that pocket fairly quickly?
We wanted to redo the Funk of Fame.
Mm.
That's basically, bro.
That's kind of where that came from.
I wasn't prepared for setting up anything, but look. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
That's three guitars. The first one goes.
Yeah.
The second one goes. But when you put it together, it is one part, and when you hear it as one part, oh my god, that shit is fucking funky.
It is funky.
excuse me for cursing.
Not at all. I think
the funk will make you curse. Damn it, that is good. And so the ability for us now to bring this to the audience in a totally perfect way for me. Why? Because not only are we playing the original parts, we're also technologically bringing you something that will mimic the sound that you hear.
Yeah.
You know, and that for me, I mean, I got to give them something that's entertaining. And so they're going to say, wait a minute, why do I hear that when I don't see that? Are they working with tape? No, that was 1980, you crazy people. We have to trigger everything live. Now, this is what technology, but you know what? Like everything else, you're not supposed to know.
You're not supposed to know?
No, because if it's technologically correct, you think it just is. You don't analyze gave it to you. There's a choir singing. Where's the choir coming from? You don't see when you see one girl singing, but it would be impossible for her to be the choir. But she is the damn choir.
I can't wait. I'm really excited about it. You're playing Berlin, aren't you? You are playing Berlin.
They asked me if I should do Berlin last. Why do you think I did Berlin first?
I don't know, Carlos.
I don't know either.
But oh, okay. I thought you were going to tell me. Okay.
Because it's going to make you wonder. If you would think of anything, you would think Back to Berlin means that the last show will be Berlin.
Yes.
I wanted the first show to be Berlin. And the last show is like Scotland and Ireland.
I know. I thought the legend would be you guys finale in Potsdamer Platz.
No. And quite honestly, Ireland and Scotland are the harder sells.
In terms of the audience?
Well, what happened is that I really considered where are the Bowie fan base? And if I look at the Bowie fan base and do a tour based on the Bowie fan base to give them what they want, then I have to look at the places that the Bowie shows have gone. I look at the places where they had tribute bands for Bowie every year, and they do very, very well. And so if they're doing something and they can easily have like a 1,000-seat place, and I come, I think that I could do a 1,000-seat place as well. And so I book it based on the fact that if the Bowie fans are there, I'm actually giving it to them. And then all the new people, those are extra for me. But in a way, I'm not really looking at the tour as whether it's successful or not. The fact that I'm doing the tour is that it's successful.
Exactly.
I'm not looking.
That's the way to look at it.
I haven't done a tour. When did I do a tribute? I did one appearance for Mike Garson. Because during the fires, the original fires in LA, he lost his house.
Yes.
And respectfully, I had to do something in order to honor his legacy with David and also to make sure that he'd be all right, you know. And so that's the only time I actually came out. And that wasn't even live. I filmed it at home and sent him the tape and we were just filmed. And so I've never really honored David Bowie by doing a tribute. I never really went and did like Eno. When did Eno do a tribute to Bowie? Has Fripp done it? No. And so I realized that I need to do something. And then when I got together with George and I realized, oh my God, George can do it. And he wanted to do it. And that's then amazing. The fire happened for him. And I was like, Carlos, you haven't done anything for Bowie. Are you out of your mind? And you almost lost George. You need to do this now, and you need to not play around. So my plan is very simple. I want to do a tribute to David Bowie, to honor David Bowie's legacy, but also in memory of Dennis Davis.
Right.
They both died the same year, and it was a really crushing blow to me. And, you know, everybody had tours already there, so you know what? You can't stop them. And you know what? Y'all are working musicians. Make your living, tour all you want. Luckily, I don't have to do that. But I encourage all of them, you know, to do it. Why not? But for me, I haven't done it. Why not? Now that the opportunity has come up, I got to do it. And you know what? I'm going to do two things. So I want to do, first I'll do Berlin Trilogy in Europe, and then hopefully Berlin Trilogy in America. And then the soulfulness of David Bowie in America, and then the soulfulness of David Bowie in Europe, and then probably Japan, because they love R&B. The Berlin, honor that period, and young Americans. I want to do the soulfulness of David Bowie with an all-black cast. And nobody can deliver that the way that I'm going to deliver it.
That was me and Carlos Alomar, and Carlos is presenting the Damn Trilogy Back to Berlin Tour 2025 that begins in Berlin on 7th of November, and I'll be there, and hopscotches then across Europe and the UK, winding up in Dublin on December the 1st. So many, many thanks to Carlos for his time talking to me. Thanks also to you for listening. Do share and subscribe to this podcast if you so wish. And keep an ear out for the next installment in my chat with Carlos, out soon. But in the meantime, bye for now.